Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Anderson. In this episode, we discuss COVID-19 antiviral resistance. Joining us are Dr. Fernando Carnevali, Division Chief of General Internal Medicine at Mount Sinai Health, Dr. Rasika Karnik, Assistant Professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Chicago, Dr. Renslow Shearer, Professor of Medicine in the Section of Infectious Diseases and Global Health at the University of Chicago, and Dr. Joseph Teresi, Clinical Pharmacy Specialist in Infectious Diseases at Grady Health System. For more information about Dr. Carnevali, Dr. Karnik, Dr. Shearer, and Dr. Teresi, and for a link to the full online educational program, including downloadable slides, please visit the links in the show notes for this episode. Now, let's get started and hear what Dr. Carnevali, Dr. Karnik, Dr. Shearer, and Dr. Teresi have to say about COVID-19 antiviral resistance.
So should we be concerned about resistance and development of new variants with antiviral therapy?
Well, I think we just are not seeing evidence of resistance as being a primary cause of either insufficient response to therapy or the rebound. So far, that's not been part of our understanding of what's causing it. That's not to say that we know. We have so many questions in relation, especially to long COVID. This is another one where I also think we should address with our patients. This is an important part of testing positively. If you continue to test yourself positively, as one set of CDC guidelines did, it's pretty common for people to stay positive 2 weeks, 3 weeks, even longer. And we don't know that that's infectious virus. It's a very good chance that that's all actually inactive virus. And we don't know that they stand for to be continuously spreading the virus. So there are some advantages to finding your one test positive, regarding that as positive, and then just following CDC guidelines for not spreading and for masking for the remainder of the next 10 days and being done. So there's still a lot of uncertainty about what does it mean that you test persistently positive? The problem with saying that broadly is you all know very well 3% of the population, and maybe some may be unknown to be immune compromised, and they may actually have ongoing virus activity. And that's a different population. That's really an important distinction. One of the themes that we would want you to take away from this, since we're encouraging the management of patients in primary care, is talk to your infectious disease colleagues frequently on this topic and refer to specialists for the immune compromised patients like the oncologists or your transplant teams, because it is a little different to manage these patients. And some of the rules that we are establishing for the general population, there may need to be exceptions for the use in immune compromised patients.
At Grady, we generally prioritize patients to get nirmatrelvir and ritonavir first in the emergency department or the ambulatory care clinics. If they have any drug interactions or any contraindication based on their renal dysfunction, we try and keep them in the ED or in the outpatient setting. We really don't like admitting people for remdesivir. Currently, we don't have an infusion clinic at Grady, so we'd rather not keep people for 3 days at the hospital when there might be an alternative available. I think we sort of go off of, at Grady, can they get nirmatrelvir and ritonavir first in the ED ambulatory care setting? And then if they can't, it's more a patient-provider decision on do you want to get IV therapy and get it sent to the ED or times one dose or go home, essentially. One thing that does come up with resistance, though, in any viral illness, there's concern for resistance, right? CMV, HIV, herpes, it comes up. And I think one of the first slides you had with the graph of the different variants we have currently, it's impossible to keep up with these new agents and a new strain comes out, and can we test against them? So I think we'll have a lot of in vitro data, and then translating that to clinical data is going to be the hardest thing to do to keep up with. So I think a lot of it is, what's the best for the patient? What do we have the best data for? So I am curious to see at my institution if we do change our practice based on some more real world data that comes out, because I think it is probably one of the bigger things we're going to have to worry about as time goes on.
Just to add on that, we're going to have therapies that will be less pills, and it will be, ritonavir will not be involved. So I think that it will continue to change that way as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what we're seeing now and what you're describing with the number of pills, you're going to improve.
I hope so.
You're going to get better.
I think for us, from my practice and our group, what I've seen is essentially similar to what you said. It's what's available, what's convenient for the patient, shared decision-making, what they prefer. Thankfully, we have an IV infusion center, so we're able to do the 3 days as an outpatient.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things at our institution really has been the logistical barriers with coming up with how do we infuse remdesivir. For those who share similar issues, essentially, SIDP, the Society of Infectious Disease Pharmacists, came out with a toolkit actually for oral and IV agents on how to set up these IV infusion centers, who to be get a part of your group, essentially who the important stakeholders would be. So there are toolkits out there to assist programs to sort of set up those infusion centers or sort of get oral therapies on board for those patients. I think it's very tough to sort of stratify. And as I said before, it'd be really nice if we can implement a nice flow sheet into the electronic medical record. So when you have your patient and you select mild COVID for these, you have four options and you can sort of select along, does your patient match the therapy that you want to prescribe? I think as time goes on, we're going to unfortunately have more patients with immunosuppression needing these agents. So I'm curious to see how many patients may need repeat courses or longer courses as more data comes out. I think that will probably change practice the most, in my opinion, just because we've had several patients who have had persistently prolonged PCRs being positive, but then we've also had patients who we felt just have had prolonged infection or new infection. And I think it comes up a lot. Well, if they got Paxlovid in the outpatient setting or nirmatrelvir or ritonavir in the outpatient setting, and we give them remdesivir a month later, is it beneficial? I don't think we have good answers for that yet. I think that's the gray area. And I don't know if you've seen that in your clinic at all or, you know, concern for patients needing that.
No, I agree with the point that you're making. I wanted to piggyback on your point about remdesivir in folks with a very low glomerular filtration rate and chronic kidney disease. We were fortunate at University of Chicago to have a third of all of our patients in the very early days enrolled in the remdesivir trial. So we saw a lot of those folks and took the same information that you had and thought, well, we should probably be using it. This is more important that we treat their COVID than this theoretical possibility.
Thank you very much to Dr. Carnevale, Dr. Karnick, Dr. Shearer, and Dr. Teresi, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full Clinical Care Options program on expert insights into optimal outpatient management of acute and long COVID-19, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. And please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you.